in leather. He unscrewed the cap and held it out to her.
It will help with your pain.
When she made no move to take it, he shrugged and tipped his head back, the liquor gurgling as it poured from the flask's mouth into his. He bared his teeth while swallowing it.
I considered ending your life in the desert, he said, screwing the cap back on and stuffing the flask inside his clothes.
Why? Chayda paused as a new wave of pain and nausea came over her. She spoke more softly.
Why didn't you?
Because there are things I wish to know. And because once I'm satisfied, there is a matter of justice to consider.
Chayda pushed herself onto her hands and knees, refusing to lie before this man any longer. But gods, the pain! Spittle flew through her clenched teeth as she fought to control it. But how could she? It was lancing through her body in a dozen places, none worse than her head.
Justice!
She managed to roll back until she was leaning against the wall opposite Husamitin. Finally, the pain began to subside.
For what? Killing men who accepted gifts from the gods and used them to murder an entire people? If you wish to deliver justice for that, I'll gladly accept it.
You admit it, then?
Husamitin's hands were on his knees, his back stiff. He stared at her like Baki, incarnate, weighing her before leading her to the farther fields.
That you took the lives of Misut and Kulishan.
With joy pouring from my heart.
He looked at her with mild surprise. Perhaps he had been expecting a different answer, but there was also a low burning anger there as well.
You have help, and I want their names. Those in the Alafu Kadar, and any others hidden within the House of Maidens.
I acted alone.
Husamitin shook his head.
Come, a child would realize that you had help. Share their names, and I can guarantee that you'll be treated with no undue cruelty. Do not, and I'll hand you over to Kahil.
Chayda debated whether she should tell Husamitin about Zaid and Isan, how the two of them had been working against the interests of the others. Might it create a rift between the kings that would help tear them down, no matter what it meant for her?
Perhaps.
But Husamitin would not stop with only two names. He wanted more. Dadzada, Emre, Masid, even old Yanka in Chayda's old neighborhood of Rose Ridge would suffer if they learned of her, and the chances of that increased the more Chayda said.
Was Melis involved?
Husamitin asked.
Was Sumeya?
You have so little confidence in my sister maidens.
Sister maidens,
Husamitin sneered. Chayda shrugged.
They were once.
No one is above suspicion. So I ask again, did any of your maidens in your hand know?
She found it strange that he would ask of Sumeya, his own daughter. She was first warden of the Blade Maidens, and was fiercely loyal to the House of Kings.
I acted alone. None of the maidens knew my purpose. They mistrusted me from the beginning, but when you, Sam, vouched for me...
And me.
The king's face was so placid she couldn't tell how much anger he was harboring behind it.
And you. After that, they fell in line. They tested my loyalty now and again, but little more than that.
And yet, the very same night you killed Kulishan, a group of scarabs stole into the catacombs of his palace and stole Khamzakir away. You would have me believe that was a chance encounter.
It was, though I won't deny it helped to distract King Kulishan.
The muscles along his jaw worked, only for a moment, but for a man like Husamitin it was an admission of rage. He turned his head toward the door and whistled sharply, a sound that drove waves of pain through Chayda.
There's more I might have asked,
he said with a calm that gave her chills. But I see you're in no mood to be forthright. Somewhere far away, a door opened. Footsteps neared. Chains clanked. There are two approaching, she realized. One set of footsteps was crisp upon the stone, the other shuffled along. She heard a wheezing breath as well, and knew long before the jailer entered the cell that An Asiya was being led to her. And yet she couldn't sense it. The Asiya crawled by the stocky man's side like an obedient hound, a collar around its neck. A chain trailed from the collar to the jailer's hand, but the jailer hardly seemed to need it. The most sickening thing wasn't that the Asiya remained close to the jailer. It was that it seemed uncomfortable unless it was near him. It had none of the irrepressible anger Chayda had grown accustomed to feeling from the Asiram, not for the jailer or Husamatin in any case. Its attitude toward Chayda was completely different. As it sat with its hands between its legs, its eyes roamed her body. The look was akin to what men did from time to time, except the Asiya didn't want sex. It wanted her flesh. It wanted to devour her. But it seemed to be waiting for something. Just what it was waiting for, Chayda wasn't sure until Husamatin crouched by the Asir's side, touched his hand to the wrinkled landscape of its bald head, and said, "Break her." The Asir leaned forward, its eyes locked on Chayda's, its lips pulled back, revealing a ruin of teeth. A terrible presence grew. Like a flash flood, pressure built quickly in her mind. She was already in pain, but now it was a pure agony. She put her hands to her forehead, hoping to press away the pain, but it did nothing. She pounded the stones with her hands, harder, harder, writhing as the Asiya tore its way deeper inside her mind. "Stop!" she called. "Blood of my blood! Please stop!" It didn't. And then, through the pain, she had a vision of her mother. Aya was leading Chayda by the hand into Dadzada's apothecary. It was the night she had left Chayda there and gone to the House of Kings. The Asiya realized. It was searching for memories as Husamatin had bid him. "No!" Chayda cried. "I beg of you, don't take these from me!" But it cared nothing for her protests. She couldn't even feel it, not as she could feel nearly every Asiya she'd come across so far. This one was more like a beast, single-minded, driven by the hand that fed it. How long might it have suffered? Decades? A century? Had this poor creature been Husamatin's ever since Bet Iman? Another vision came, of Chayda accepting a mission. A shade from Osman. She saw Emre joining her. The two of them trading secrets when Tariq gave them their separate destinations. "Stop!" Crouched on her rooftop, she waits for Emre's return. She knows he won't, so she takes a petal, lifting it from her mother's locket and placing it under her tongue. How it fills her with power. With pain, with worry. The memories mix with reality as the Asiya digs ever deeper. She runs the streets on Bet Jair. The city lies quiet, a mighty beast in slumber. She finds Emre in the canals, wounded. They maneuver up the old tree and back to the streets. Emre falls unconscious. And she sees it. An Asiya. She'd hoped in those days never to see one, never thought to stand before one. She waits, petrified, as it nears, and whispers long-forgotten words into her ear. "Rest will he, neath twisted tree." The Asiya takes her head in its dry hands and places a kiss on her forehead. Its lips so warm it repulses her. There is another presence nearby. She feels herself, Husamatin's hound, and one more.
But where?
She turns and looks around the street, which now stands empty. She blinks. She was back in Husamatine's dungeon. But the presence? It was still there and growing. She recognized it and wondered if her memory had somehow summoned him. Sahid Alaz. He was near, though exactly where Chayda couldn't say. He seemed to be all around her, attacking the Aesir, Husamatine's hound. Chayda's breath came in great gasps. Sweat gathered along her brow, on her palms and the backs of her arms. Only a short distance away, close enough to touch, Husamatine's Aesir rolled across the cell, as she had done only a short while ago. It scraped at the stones with fingers raw and bleeding. Streaks of black blood were left across the floor in strange, sickening patterns. And then the Aesir stopped and lay still, its eyes staring into Chayda's.
"I'm sorry," Chayda said.
The Aesir did not reply. Dark blood dripped from its nose. Its mouth worked as if it were trying to speak. She hadn't realized how young it was. This was a child whose whole life had been stolen from it.
"Well, well," Husamatine said.
He turned to look at the wall to Chayda's right.
"Sahid Alaz is there," Chayda thought. "So close I could call to him and he would hear."
The King of Swords seemed ill-pleased that Chayda had noticed what he was doing. He stared down at her.
"Gather your strength, Chedamin Ayanashala. We'll continue your questioning soon."
And with that he swept from the room, while the jailer took up the lantern and used the chain around the Aesir's neck to drag it from the room, shutting the door behind him with a heavy clatter. Soon the sounds of their departure had dwindled to nothing, leaving Chayda alone in the darkness, with the dripping sound in the distance. When Chayda woke again, her mind was muddy. It took her a long while to remember Husamatine and the Aesir. Sahid Alaz had come to her in her dreams. Indeed, the dream itself had been an echo of their first meeting. It had seemed true to the events, as they had happened, but then the differences had begun to grow. It was due to her growing awareness of Sahid Alaz, she understood, that she had been able to sense them at all. Now she understood his purpose as well. He had been working to hide certain memories from the Aesir. She pushed herself up off the floor and scraped back along the stones until she could lean against the wall and cradle her aching head in her hands. Her heart ached for that creature. The lives of the Aesirim might be poor, but at least they remembered themselves somewhat. That one had been so robbed of its humanity that it had become loyal to Husamatine. It led her to a problem she hadn't anticipated. The King of Swords was more adept at controlling the Aesirim than she had given him credit for. He'd proven it in the desert when she had wanted to enlighten Melis, and he had concealed the young Aesir's memories and replaced them with his own. And again, here in the dungeon, she had assumed the kings would be at a disadvantage with Misut gone. But she had clearly been mistaken. She massaged her forehead slowly. It hurt terribly, but not as badly as with the Aesir.
When had that been? Yesterday?
She had lost track of time in this place. She searched and found a water cup she had caught a glimpse of earlier. After downing all of it, she gripped her right hand, felt the old wound come to life. It had been quiet, almost numb, but the more she squeezed, the more effects of the poison spread. She'd become accustomed to it now, knowing how much she could push and how quickly before it overwhelmed her. She took just enough and reached out carefully for some sense of Sahid Alaz.
"What are you, my king?"
She was nearly ready to give up, when she felt the barest glint of light on the edges of her mind.
Is that you?
She reached further, knowing that whatever kept Sahid Alaz enthralled did so still. She was aware that Husam Atin might be watching, that other kings might be as well, but she didn't care. She had to take this chance while she could.
What happened?
She asked. At last, Sahid Alaz spoke.
I thought you safe, my child. You should not have returned.
Cheda's heart rejoiced to hear him.
There is too much to do. Sharakai cannot be ignored.
No, but now you are back in their grasp.
Yet all is not lost, my king. Our tribe forms once more in the desert. They lift their swords in honor of Ishak Kihanava and in honor of you. More will come, and the kings now know it.
She said it so that Sahid Alaz would take heart, knowing his efforts had not been in vain. Indeed, it seemed to spark a memory in him. She saw her king riding at the prow of a ship, a line of mountains in the distance. She saw the tribe celebrating in a valley, with steep walls covered in evergreens and a lake so clear, even the deepest folds of its bed were laid bare.
Yes,
Cheda said, reveling in the memory with him. The reminder of her presence drew his thoughts to darker times, to the call of Tulathan, to the transformation he had gone through on a different mountain, this one in the center of a vast desert city. Through him she heard the cackle of Sukru and the crack of his whip as he reveled in the pain of those who had been given to the gods. Sahid Alaz had watched as the other kings bade his people to throw themselves against the army of the desert tribes.
Do not go, he managed to say. Do not heed their call.
They had not listened. The call of the gods was already upon them. In ones and twos their shriveled forms had hunched. They'd loped forward, and oh, how they howled as they ran. It sent shivers of regret through Sahid Alaz. They had become a terrible host, and were now preparing to storm the lines of the gathered tribes and break the siege of the city. For a long while, all Cheda could think of was her conversation with Dadzada in the desert.
Have you not considered that it's Sahid Alaz himself who must be led to the farther fields in order for the Asiram to be freed?
But what was there to do about that now? Come, my king, she said to him. For now, let us look to the future, not the past.
Sahid Alaz was silent and still, suddenly fearful for himself, for Cheda. He'd sensed another near them, and now Cheda did too, someone listening like a thief in the shadows. She remembered the telltale scuff of feet when she had awakened. She pushed herself up, shambled to the door, and held the iron bars of the window. She pressed her face into the gap and called,
You needn't fear! I'm locked in a cage!
There was no reply. She tried again to feel for whoever was hiding there, but felt nothing. They were either too distant or too skilled at masking their presence. Sitting back down, she tried once more to reach out to Sahid Alaz, but he was gone as well. Alone in the darkness, Cheda gave up and fell into a fitful sleep. Chapter 38. When Isan returned to his palace, the bright fury he had felt in Zaheb's throne room had diminished to a burning crimson flame, one of many that lit him with purpose, that fueled him when it felt like the road he travelled was too dangerous, or too long, or too ambitious. If he had been the only one threatened by Zaheb, he might have overlooked it. He was a patient man, and could afford to be more patient because of the elixir Nayan had perfected to carry him through the decades that lay ahead. But Zaheb hadn't been satisfied with threatening only Isan. he'd threatened Nyan.
And worse, Isan's unborn child. There was nothing he wouldn't do to protect her.
You have grossly underestimated me, my good king.
Something's happened, Nyan said to him a few nights later. What is it?
He told her nothing about Zaheb, nor would he for now.
Kiral, I can't wipe his smug face from my mind.
He had ordered his scribes to copy every single one of Yusam's journals before delivering the originals to Kiral. He had tried reading the duplicates in the days since, but he had got nowhere. He couldn't concentrate on the complexities of Yusam's visions. He hadn't lied to Nyan. He was annoyed by Kiral, but he was consumed by how helpless he had felt in the darkness of Zaheb's throne room, how inconsequential in the face of Zaheb's bloody henchman, the Kestrel, who held him down like some base criminal, an afterthought, a piece of dross. And Zaheb, cloaking himself in righteous indignation, as if Isan was in the wrong.
You've made a terrible error, my good king. You've no idea what I could do to you.
Nyan, naked in bed next to him, shoved him.
You're brooding again.
I know, he said. I'll stop.
Good.
But perhaps only after I walk into Kiral's palace and command his men to deliver the journals here. Perhaps I'll have Kiral hand me his crown while I'm at it.
Nyan shrugged.
Be prepared to meet Sun Shira if you do. I might tell him to run it through his own gut, like Husamitin does with that bloody black sort of his.
Isan smiled, picturing it, but Nyan became suddenly serious and propped herself up on one elbow.
Do you think he would?
He pulled her back down, ran his fingers through her hair.
It was only a jest.
I know,
she replied, taking his hand and kissing it several times. She shifted closer, lifted one leg and lay it across his.
But if it came to that,
she moved closer, ran her fingertips through the hair on his chest.
Would he?
As her fingers moved steadily lower along his stomach, he stared at the grand ceiling above. He felt the warmth of her sex as she began grinding slowly against his hip.
In truth, I'd give even chances between him complying and my head being lopped off in the moments he was able to resist.
She scratched the hair between his legs, her hand brushing unsubtly against his rapidly hardening cock. Using one finger, she touched his helm, as she called it, and ran soft circles around it. Pleasure swelled as she gripped his shaft and slid the skin down until it could go no further. She held it for two beats of his heart, kissing him warmly on the neck, then began to stroke him in long, slow movements.
May it never come to that.
He ran his hand down her back, admiring her by touch alone. She pulled the sheet and blanket back, exposing him to the knees, then moved herself steadily downward, using the drape of her hair to tickle his shoulders, his chest, his stomach, all the while continuing to stroke him. He twisted in the bed and moved his head between her thighs, kissing, licking, taking her in his mouth as she did the same with him. For a time, the two of them lost themselves in one another, moving like the hot currents of air that eddied around Turiat in the height of summer, twining, moving through one another until they crested, each shuddering rhythmically, Nyan first, then Isan. They descended like the waning sun and lay side by side, languid, as the end of day. Her head cradled against his chest, one of her legs draped over his, she spoke softly.
I tell you true. If Tulathan came this very night and said if I would lose a hand, I could walk in the open with you. I would do it.
She looked up at him.
Wouldn't you?
He made a show of considering it.
Would it have to be my hand?
Insult and injury somehow accentuated the sultry look in her eyes as she formed the perfect smile.
You would rather I give one of mine?
Squeezing her right breast with one hand, a smooth cheek of her buttocks with the other, he said,
I need both of mine.
And I don't?
He took her hand and placed it on his softening cock.
One will do.
She gripped him and squeezed hard. When he ground his hips into the motion and released a ridiculously exaggerated moan of pleasure, she bit his nipple until he shouted for her to stop. Laughing, they fell into silence and stillness once more. His mind lingered, though. He would walk with her in the light of day. They couldn't hide her pregnancy forever. And he didn't know that he wanted to, because no one knew the effect the transformation might be having on the child as it grew within her. They had taken to using the necklace less and less. Nyan declined the vast majority of official functions, and those where King Azad did make an appearance, it was kept as short as possible. The other kings had noticed and had questioned it in their last council meeting before Beth Jair. In her disguise as Azad, Nyan had given them prepared excuses, most related to the threat of the moonless host in Sharakai. With the danger of the host all but extinguished, however, Isam would need to find another excuse.
Is it time for Nyan to step forward as queen?
He wondered aloud. She looked up at him, considering, perhaps, weighing his earnestness.
Not yet.
She was right, of course.
But how he wished for it.
Soon,
he said. The same useless, grating refrain he had been spouting for years. From beyond the scalloped archway leading to his sitting room, a bell rang. As he slipped from the bed and pulled on a silk robe, it rang again.
My Lord King,
came a hoary voice. It was Tolovan, but he sounded excited, a quality no one would typically associate with that placid man. Isan moved quickly to the small greeting room, where heavy green curtains were draped across the entry to his apartments.
Come, he said.
Tolovan's tall form pushed through the curtains. His face was flushed with worry.
Excellence, he said in an undertone. Word has come. Jader has been captured.
Isan felt a tingling sensation run along his spine and went to his dressing room. Tolovan followed.
Where is she being kept?
Isan called over his shoulder.
Husamatin's palace.
Husamatin, Isan thought.
He's nearly as bad as Kahil and Kiral. He was so bloody inflexible. Tell me what you know. She was apparently taken near the blooming fields by Husamatin himself and the blade maidens in Cheda's old hand. Has she been questioned? I wasn't told, my lord king. Send the messenger now. Inform them I'll be arriving shortly and request that they wait for my arrival before doing anything further.
When Tolovan had left, Nyan said,
I'll join you,
already half-dressed in King Azad's raiment.
We can't both appear interested. Return to your palace. I'll send word once it's done.
Nyan was clearly eager to join him.
I told you she was dangerous.
I never disagreed.
But you've still not cut her loose. You should have months ago.
Not now, Nyan.
She looked like she wanted to say more, but she held her tongue and left. When Isan reached Husamatin's palace, he heard shouting well before he reached the throne room. Husamuddin's vizira, a woman who could easily be mistaken for the king's twin, showed him inside, where he found Husamuddin with three other kings, Kiral, Sukru, and Kahil. They looked as if they were in the streets outside an oud parlor, a brawl about to begin. Kiral and Sukru stood to one side, watching Kahil practically scream at Husamuddin. And Husamuddin, their king of swords, lord of the blade maidens, was standing at the foot of the dais before his throne, arms crossed, his face serene as a block of bloody granite. His sword, Knight's Kiss, hung by his side, as much a part of the stoic king as his broad shoulders, his closely shorn hair or his dark, trim beard. It was, Isan decided, as delicious a scene as he could remember in the halls of Toriat.
"She attacked me," Cahill railed. "She killed two of your brother kings. She nearly killed Indrith, my daughter, who's still in pain every waking moment from her injuries."
"Be that as it may,"
Husamuddin said, his dark eyes unimpressed by Cahill's argument.
"I found her in the desert. If she is a prize, then she is mine to do with as I please."
"A prize?"
spittle flew from Cahill's mouth.
"She is a traitor!"
"And will be treated as such," Husamuddin said evenly.
"I have the right to question her. I demand it."
When Husamuddin remained unswayed, Cahill turned to Kiral, for all the world an angry boy appealing to his baba. Kiral stared at him a moment, the pockmarks on his face standing out in the light thrown by the braziers along the walls.
"Our confessor king has a point," he said, lifting his eyes to Husamuddin. "I have not asked you here," Husamuddin said, "to discuss how Chedamin will be treated, or where, nor by whom. I informed you out of courtesy, and to seek your counsel. I used one of my hounds on her, to unlock her secrets, but Sihid Alaz came to her aid. I might try again, but I fear he may break his bonds, and then..."
"Enough!"
Cahill broke in.
"I am not requesting permission. I have come for the traitor, and I will have her."
"My good kings," Isan said before Husamuddin could respond. But Cahill went on.
"I have the right to question her. If Husamuddin has doubts about how far I'll go to protect that right..."
Both hands moved to his weapons, his right to a gleaming warhammer, his left to a long, curved fighting knife.
"He may say so now."
Isan came to a stop several paces away, but turned as the throne room doors were opened behind him. Zaheb had joined them. He stared, clearly confused. Sukru eyed Husamuddin as if he were ready to uncoil his whip and stand beside Cahill. Kiral was raising his hands, ready to play the role of diplomat, but Husamuddin spoke before he could.
"I do not wish for this to come to blows, Cahill, Tharis Allah. But I know that if it does, it will not end until one of us lies dead."
He'd not moved an inch toward the pommel of his sword, but Isan could see how ready he was. Cahill was incensed. His callow face reddened. Enraged, he drew his knife and pointed it at Husamuddin's head.
"I will have that girl!"
"You will not,"
came Husamuddin's easy reply.
"Enough!"
Kiral shouted, raising his hands in a sign of peace. But Husamuddin was already on the move. He drew Knight's Kiss, a razor-sharp length of glimmering ebon steel. Before it had even cleared its scabbard, Cahill charged, drawing and swinging his bright warhammer in a downward blow. Husamuddin sidestepped and used the draw of his sword to slash for Cahill's exposed side. Cahill blocked with his fighting knife while swinging the hammer's sharp point for Husamatin's sword arm. He actually caught him, the point tearing the sleeve of Husamatin's kalat and drawing blood. But their knight's kiss was blurring through the air. Cahill was immediately driven back. The ring of their weapons filled the audience hall. Sukru looked on with wild eyes, Kiral with horror. Isan actually considered letting them fight. He would shed no tears for Cahill. And if Husamatin were killed, well, he might have lost a potential ally, but the man was a rigid obstacle. Isan would have to contend with one day anyway. What better way than for their king of truth, Cahill, to have done it for him? Isan might even press for Cahill to lose a hand for what he'd done. He was an imbecile who, much like his pretty, boyish face, never seemed to mature. His fall from grace could only serve to help Isan. Kiral ordered them both to stop, and they ignored him. Night's kiss blurred. It hummed like a rattlewing, darkness billowing in its wake. Cahill tried to mount an offensive, but Husamatin was quick as his blade. He foiled every attempt Cahill made to strike, taking not so much as another scratch, while Knight's kiss delivered a cut along Cahill's thigh, another to his shoulder, a third that cost Cahill his fighting knife as Husamatin's sword cut viciously across his guard. Isan waited, knowing that to act too soon would turn too much attention on him. But when Sukru, a staunch ally of Cahill's, uncoiled his whip and Kiral warded him away with a wave of his long arm, he knew it was time. As Husamatin's sword described a blinding, buzzing flurry of blows, Isan put up his hands and roared, "Stop!" Tulathan's power flowed as his voice stormed through the room. The walls could hardly contain it. He felt it reach out and seize Husamatin and Cahill. In truth, Isan didn't know what the effect would be. He had used it so rarely on the kings and never on these two. They were both so headstrong, he thought perhaps they would shrug it off. Husamatin at least, if not Cahill. But neither did. Both halted, lowering their weapons, and turned toward Isan as if awaiting orders. "Please," Isan said, drawing less of Tulathan's power. "We cannot fight over one prisoner, traitor or not." He took a step toward them, his hands to his sides in an open, placating gesture. "Your battle does the work of our enemies for them. There must be some arrangement we can make. Husamatin mentioned Sahid Alaz. We cannot risk him commanding more of the Asiram against us, nor can we risk his death." Isan motioned carefully towards Sukru. "Why not give Chedamin to a neutral party? Sukru has a young mage in his house who might work to unlock her secrets."
"The mage knows her,"
Husamatin said slowly, as if he was just risen from a very long slumber.
"They were childhood friends in Rose Ridge."
His eyes were angry and a touch confused. No doubt part of him wished to separate Cahill's head from his shoulders, much like Zaheb after he had recovered from the effects of Isan's power. Husamatin would be angry about what Isan had done. But Isan had appealed to the part of him that searched for tranquility. Husamatin was a man more accustomed to the grip of a sword than anyone else in the great Shangazi. Yet he also valued accord and the gains that could be made in times of peace.
"What of it?" Isan said. "Sukru can oversee the proceedings. We can all be there to watch. Once we have what we want, we can decide who will take charge of our errant maiden."
For long moments no one spoke. Sukru looked pleased, though it was difficult to tell on his perpetually sour face. Zaheb watched Isan warily. Husamitin and Cahill stared at one another, the air between them charged. Cahill wisely slipped his hammer back into its steel ring in his belt.
"Very well," he said, keeping his eyes on Husamitin.
"Very well,"
Isan echoed, turning to Husamitin.
"Might it not be better to separate Cheder from Sahid Alaz in any case?"
Husamitin was still eyeing Cahill intently. He glanced at Isan, but then nodded once to Kiral, sheathing Knight's kiss.
"We are agreed," Isan said. "Let Sukru take Cheder to his palace, where we'll meet on the morrow's afternoon, and then we shall see what we shall see."
Isan used none of his power now. He couldn't risk any more than he already had, and he was already certain they would agree to his request. Kiral, ever the statesman, nodded first, then the others, at which point Isan nodded back to them all with a calculated smile.
"Very good. I'm sure you'll have arrangements to make."
And with that, he gave a quick bow of his head while backing away. When he turned to head for the exit, he ignored Zaheb completely. As he closed the door behind him, he heard Husamitin say something, but he could spare no more thought for them. He had a very short window of time if the other part of this harried plan was to work. It took all the patience he had to keep his pace steady as he walked to his heavy coach and waited as its four horses pulled out from the courtyard and began winding down the mountain toward his palace. When the path met King's Road, he called for the driver to stop.
"Unbuckle the horse,"
he said, stepping out of the coach.
"Yes, Excellence."
When he'd done that, Isan leapt up to the back of the horse, gripping the Akala's silvery mane.
"Wait for me below my palace, on the hidden bend. Speak of this to no one."
Gripped in Isan's power, the driver nodded numbly, climbed up to the bench, and gave the reins a sharp snap. Then Isan was off, riding hard for Sukru's palace. The gates were open, and Isan rode through. Several silver spears watched from the walls and from the gatehouse. A footman approached, with more servants standing at the entrance to the palace. Isan had used his power sparingly over the years for many reasons, but this was no time for half measures.
"Attend me,"
he shouted, opening the floodgates. His power flowed through the courtyard, drove its way through doors and windows. All those who heard came and stood before him. It felt good to let the full effect of Tulathan's gift course through him. It was a heady thing, vibrant, nearly as strong as the moment the goddess had spoken his bloody verse, thereby granting him his second voice. A score of men and women came to him, arranging themselves in a ragged circle, attentive, eager to please.
"You have a young man named Davud in your care," Isan said.
"We do,"
they spoke in unison.
"Take me to him."
Chapter 39.
"He's here, my lord king,"
Davud heard from the hallway outside his room.
"Forget what you've seen this night," said a soft voice. "Forget what you've heard. This has been a night like any other."
"Quite right, your excellence, it has."
Davud sat up in bed, confused.
"My lord king," the voice had said, but the voice wasn't Sukru's.
"Go now,"
commanded the anonymous king. A sound of shuffling footsteps lifted and faded, the servant complying with the king's request, and then Davud's door creaking lightly open. Honey-colored light spilled into the room as a man stepped inside, his features hidden behind a lantern. Davud could tell he was of medium height and build. When he came closer and the lantern's light reflected off the bed covers, he could see more. the king's rich raiment, amber-accented in blue and thread of gold, his handsome face with its impeccably manicured beard.
You are Davood?
I am, Excellence.
You and I have a lot to talk about.
Davood was terribly confused and nervous, but when the king smiled, it chased away all the worries that had been building inside.
I've been most curious about your story, your time with Khamsakhir. You and I could probably spend a night and a day talking about it, but our time is limited.
As the king sat at the foot of the bed, Davood finally recognized him. This was Isan, the honey-tongued king. He was certain this should worry him, but just then he couldn't put his finger on the reason.
Of course, Your Excellence.
You've been here for some time now. Tell me what Sukru has been teaching you.
Nothing,
Davood said in all honesty. The king seemed more than a little surprised.
If anything, I've been teaching him.
He would never have spoken it so plainly before anyone else, but Isan seemed an eminently trustworthy soul.
He's not provided you instruction to broaden the use of your magic.
He's given me books. I've broadened my own knowledge, as has Anila.
It felt strange to talk about Anila, but he was eager to please the king. Indeed, when Isan smiled quizzically, as if Davood had both surprised and impressed him, his heart swelled.
Anila,
he said.
She was the only other survivor of the attack on the Khalija's graduation ceremony.
She was burned in Ishmantep?
Isan asked. When Davood nodded, he went on.
I thought her dead. Her survival is a miracle, to be sure. She's been here since our return, healing. But lately she's been learning how to commune with the dead.
Isan's eyes narrowed to slits.
I beg your pardon.
Gods, he was angry or disappointed. It was a secret Davood should probably have kept hidden, but sharing anything with Isan gave him a thrill.
She isn't dangerous,
he said quickly.
But she can bring the dead back from the abyss, at least for a time.
Davood told him all of it, how she had raised Bella from the dead.
She's a good woman at heart. She just wants to use her power to destroy Khamsakhir.
And Sukru?
Isan said pensively.
You said you were teaching him.
Teaching him what?
He asked for my help to determine the cause of the sickness in the Adhikara. He thought it might be related to the growing madness in the Asirum.
And you were successful?
Yes, until Yurinde came.
If Isan had seemed disappointed before, he seemed utterly shocked now.
What did you just say?
Yurinde came to us in the caverns below Toriat, my lord king.
He proceeded to tell him all of it. The shift in mood, the goddess striding in, those depthless eyes.
Bring me her head, she had commanded the kings, the head of she who has wronged thee.
Yurinde said this.
She did, Excellence.
And then she left.
Yes.
And who was in attendance?
Myself and Anila, Sukru's man, Zandrithus.
Which kings, Davood?
King Sukru, Kiral, Kahil, and Husamitin.
Isan was lost in thought, his face heavy in shadows from the light cast by the lantern. Suddenly he breathed sharply, as if returning to himself.
There's something I wish you to do for me, Davood.
Anything.
You know a woman named Chedamin, I believe.
This struck something deep within Davood. Love, friendship, loyalty.
I do.
She will be brought here tonight to be interrogated by you. You will find a way to free her by any means necessary. She cannot remain here under the power of King Sukru.
Cheda,
brought here.
But she fled the city.
She foolishly returned Davud, and she's been captured. Here's what you will do.
The king leaned closer, took Davud by the back of the neck, and gazed into his eyes in a way that was not so different from what Yerinde had done in the cavern. Isan spoke, but Davud could no longer understand the words. He caught one here, escape, another there, blood. But so much was lost, the sound was akin to the snap of a bonfire, as mesmerizing as the flames. All too soon Isan was standing.
Do you understand all I have told you?
Of course, my lord king.
Very well,
Isan said, moving like a memory toward the door. The moment it thudded home, Davud was up and washing his face. He had much to prepare for, but he started only a short while later, suddenly aware of a new presence in the room.
My king?
He expected to find Isan, but it wasn't him. It was another.
You will forget my face,
came a voice so soft it was nearly a whisper.
And you will forget that I was here.
Just like that, the form blurred, becoming like a shadow.
Of course,
Davud said.
There is one last request your king has for you, Davud. The most important of all.
Anything.
When you have done all Isan has asked of you, you will take Chedamin's life, and then you will take your own.
I...
It seemed an odd request.
Excellence, are you certain that is what you wish?
I'm certain.
Davud nodded.
Then it will be done.
Very good, Davud.
And the door clicked shut. After retrieving the golden triangle from the bureau at his bedside, Davud picked up his candle and moved to the patio. It was night yet, but the sky was overcast, no starlight visible. He gave the triangle a spin, hoping it would work anyway, but it fell, tinkling against the mosaic tabletop.
Perhaps it only needs time.
As he held it in his palm, hoping the night sky would grant it the power it needed, he rubbed his temples, trying to clear a bit of the pain. He'd had a terrible headache since waking and setting about the tasks he'd been set by... Now that was strange. He couldn't recall who.
I'm tired. I can worry about that when the sun rises.
He spun the triangle again and again. It rattled against the tabletop. He tried a third time and a fourth.
God, no! He needed this to work.
The sparrow's words played in his mind.
You need but summon the sigil for passage and doorway,
he had said. The moment he had spoken those words, Davud had felt wary. He'd said it pleasantly. With kindness, it seemed. But this whole situation, Sukru and the hunger in his close-set eyes, Anila and her growing power, the sudden appearance of the sparrow in his stories of Sukru, it all had Davud on edge. He mightn't have done it now, not if it was for him alone, but this was to save Cheda. She was here at least in part because of him. He had been the one to show her the tunnel to the Collegia Tower. He had helped her uncover the king's secrets.
Sasha's bright blade. Who was it who told me Cheda was captured? Sukru?
The triangle glinted in the candlelight. He picked it up, felt the sharp edge of one of the corners, carefully considering what he was about to do.
Such a treacherous path.
In that brief moment of indecision, his headache became markedly stronger, and he decided it was worth the risk. He pressed the triangle into his thumb, piercing skin and worked the flesh until blood welled. He drew the sigil the sparrow had described on his palm, then placed the triangle there and gripped it. Immediately he felt a hollow sensation building in his stomach. It came on so swiftly he threw the triangle from him. It turned in the air and wobbled like a top. But then it started to rotate more smoothly and grew. The sides expanded, becoming larger and larger until each was nearly as long as Davood was tall. What shocked him more was that the triad's center now revealed not the trunk of the fig tree behind it, but another place entirely. Davood approached carefully. Within the triangle's borders was a room with sandstone walls. A clutch of candles held in an iron sconce lit the room in pale light. On the far wall stood a shelf of books and scrolls of all sizes, plus a host of clay tablets in wooden trays. There was a rocking chair on a rug, a hearth beside it. Dominating the left side of the room was a table of thick wood, like a butcher's block. All about the space were cages, both large and small, some on decks, others on pedestals, others still hanging from the walls and ceiling. Within were dozens, hundreds of small birds. There were many firefinches like the one the sparrow had sent to spy on Davood and to deliver him the triangle, and many others besides. Berry peckers and tail runners, saddlebacks and thornbills. A dozen more Davood had no name for. "Hello?" Davood called softly. "Sparrow?" The birds chirped softly, some fluttering in their cages before settling once more. "Hello?" he called again. Taking a deep breath, he screwed up his courage, hiked up his robes, and stepped through. He moved swiftly lest the thing return to its previous size and chop him in two. The triangle, however, continued to spin.
"Hello, it's Davood. I've come to speak to you."
The fire was low in the hearth, but the room was quite warm. Davood peered into the darkness beyond the open door, fearful of leaving the triangle lest it close and trap him here. There was nothing for it, though. He was committed. As he took a step toward the open door, he noticed a book in the rocking chair. A journal, perhaps. He was reaching for it when a voice spoke from the darkened hallway.
"So cometh the young mage."
At the sudden sound, the birds flapped noisily about their cages, then settled like wind-blown leaves.
I've just come from Sukru's palace." "I'd be surprised if you'd come from another."
He thought he'd known who he was speaking to, but now he wasn't so sure. The voice sounded deeper, more hoarse.
"I'm here to see the sparrow."
The shadow shifted, and Davood could just make out the silhouette of a smallish man. The voice said non-committally.
"I'm pleased you've come. I began to wonder if you'd ever take up my offer." "I haven't come to take up your offer. Exactly, not yet, in any case." "Not yet? I need your help. There's someone who will need shelter. She must be hidden from the kings and then seen safely into the desert."
An uncomfortable silence followed.
"Would the kings be wroth to learn of her departure?"
"Yes."
The birds flapped noisily for a moment.
"Who is she to you that you would risk so much?"
"A friend."
"A friend?"
the sparrow echoed.
"Who is she to the kings, then?"
Davood didn't wish to reveal Chayda's identity, but he supposed there would be no hiding it in the end. Better to let the sparrow know now than discover it when he needed his help the most.
"When we first spoke, you said you would do much to anger Sukru."
"And it was the truth."
"The woman is known as the White Wolf. She took up an ebon blade, but has since been named a traitor. She killed two of the kings, if the stories are true.
Davud felt certain he had erred in sharing this, but then a deep chuckle issued forth from the dark.